Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from the newsroom of PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Powell. A refugee detained on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island by Australia has escaped to Fiji, where he is now seeking asylum. Longmen Sawari fled persecution in Iran to Australia at the age of 17, but was imprisoned on Manus Island even though he was a minor. He tried to settle in PNG. Now age 21, Longmen told his story to Ben Robinson Drawbridge about his remarkable story starting in the detention camp on Manus.
And from that camp, I went to Leh, because the immigration, they told me, we go to send you there and we find for you school. I went to Leh, and the immigration, they find for me the accommodation in Chinatown. Chinatown is a dangerous place. The more than two times, I saw the rush call, they coming to stealing something from other people. And I complaining to immigration. I told them, if it's not safe, why you bring me here? I need security. I cannot stay here because it's not safe for me. And then I left that accommodation because it's not safe for me. I went to PA Advances, and I met that church, and they helped me to stay there. I stayed for 1 month maybe, or more than 1 month there. And then I tried to contact with immigration, but they don't want me to go back to Manus, because I told them Leh is not safe. I have to go back to Manus. The immigration, they say, no, you have to stay here because you settlement already. I'm lucky, guys, because I find some good people to stay with them. With some street boys, and those street boys, they helped me to find the food and find the place in Leh.
You asked to go back to Manus, and they said no, but you tried to go back anyway, didn't you?
Yes, I went to Manus, and they closed the gate, and I sleep outside the gate. They don't allow me to go inside the camp. And then they put me in one hotel. It's not hotel, it's just guest house. Every day they came, and they said, if you want, you have to go back to Leh. I tell them, I cannot go back to Leh. And every day they do some punishment with me. They tell that don't give him food, no any allowance to, you know, buy credit to call my parents, no nothing. They don't give me. They say you have to go back. They do a lot of punishment with me, those immigration of PNG. And then after a few days, I tell them, no, I don't want to go. And I went to camp. I went with my friends. His name is Abdul Latif. And when I came to camp, they bring the police and they arrest me and him. And they put me in that police station again. And I asked the immigration, is what my crime? What I did? I want to go inside with other people if I'm refugee. From the jail, I went to that same accommodation, the immigration they provided for me. I find some people, they say, okay, we know your story. We can help you to go outside of Manus and you will enjoy. I tell them, okay. And they took me, one island is next to Indonesia for 2 weeks. When I see that, that island is not safe for me, I came back again to Manus. And they say, okay, now you can go back to camp if you want. And they send me to camp again. After that, JDA, the one of the company, they say, okay, you want to go back to Port Moresby? I tell them, no, I don't want. And next night, I went with one of my cousin to one club. For first time in my life, I go to club in the night. And then when I went to club and when we came back from the club night, I see one car, a big car. 10 people, they come in, they beat me and they steal my phone. And the next day I was, very scared. And then the next day, JDA man, he know about this thing. He say, okay, you want to go now to Moresby? I tell him, yes, I am tired of Manus now. Because last night I get beat and they steal my phone. Some group of local people. And those local, they get support from the PNG immigration. Because those people, they live in next to detention camp. They live there and they work in the camp. And some of those, the immigration, they beat me in that night and they stole my phone.
I understand. So they were trying to scare you to leave.
And then to leave, yes, that's right, to leave in Moresby. And I told them, okay, next day, I told them I'm ready to go. The immigration, they provide for me ticket and they send me to Moresby. They find for me accommodation. They call that place Gerahu. Gerahu is not safe also. When I talk to landowner of that house, he say, why they bring you here? Because this area is not safe for you. And I cannot help you guys if someone beat you outside. I was in 4 months in that house. And every day they told me, white man, every day they told me, give me smoke. I tell them I'm not smoking.
Were they beating you? Were they hurting you?
Yes. Many times. I told them I have to give you guys text. I am just refugee. And when they stole my key, I report to immigration office. I told them those people, they stole my key and I cannot go back to that accommodation. It's not safe, Gerahu. and you have to provide for me security. They say, no. They say, it's your problem. Again, I left, I went with my friend, stay with him for 2 months. And then I find some, I don't know, you call him smugglers people. I told them to do for me passport. And they do for me a local passport. And when I try to go to New Zealand or other country, I cannot because they need visa. And then I talk to some local people. They said, you can go to Fiji. Some family in Australia and my family also. And I have something, I sold them and I get money and I come to Fiji.
With an election looming in Fiji next year, the commission responsible for overseeing preparations has been allowed to lapse out of existence. The 3-year term of the Electoral Commission expired on the 9th of January, and an oversight body was supposed to appoint a new commission by that time, but it hasn't happened. And opposition parties say that's concerning for Fiji's nascent democracy. Jamie Tahanaha reports.
Under Fiji's 2013 constitution and the 2014 elections decree, the Electoral Commission is an independent body tasked with supervising the elections office, which is responsible for preparing the vote. It's appointed for a 3-year term, but that term quietly ended on the 9th of January, and there appears to have been no rush to replace it. The leader of the opposition National Federation Party, Biman Prasad, says that's concerning.
The term of the commission and the chairman ended on the 9th of January. So that means that they are no longer commissioners, and that means there is no longer an electoral commission in place. And that's serious because, you know, it's a constitutional office. You know, it shouldn't be allowed to remain vacant. And this is exactly what has happened.
Biman Prasad says before the commission's term ended, an oversight body chaired by the Prime Minister, the Constitutional Officers Commission, was supposed to appoint a new one, or extend the term of the former one. It didn't do that, and almost a month later, Dr. Prasad says it's not clear when the Constitutional Officers Commission plans to meet to carry out its duty. Vijay Naidu, a professor of development studies at the University of the South Pacific and a former member of the Electoral Commission, says it's worrying that it's been allowed to lapse. He says what's more concerning, though, is that the elections office is now working unsupervised.
I don't think that's a very good thing. You know, the thing is that the supervisor of election is only accountable in terms of what he's doing with regards to this electoral commission, but he's also answerable to the minister for election, who is also the general secretary of the ruling party.
Professor Naidu, who stepped down from the commission in 2015 over frustrations with the supervisor of elections, Mohamed Sanim, says that raises questions about potential conflicts of interest, especially in light of a recent court ruling. In November, the Court of Appeal ruled in favour of a case brought by the commission against the electoral office, finding that Mr. Sanim had acted contrary to the commission's directions.
He had set about overruling us in a decision that meant that a number of candidates were disadvantaged and excluded from participating in the election. And at least one person was allowed to stand in the election, whom the Electoral Commission had determined shouldn't be allowed to do so.
Professor Naidu says that compounds his worries, as the elections office's preparations for next year's polls are already under full swing. The Electoral Office, Mr. Sanim, the government and the former chairman of the Electoral Commission have not responded to requests for comment. In the meantime, however, Mr. Sanim told the Fiji Times he is continuing to work hard towards next year's elections and has no plans to suspend his work while there's no commission. This is Jamie Tahana.
Preparations for Papua New Guinea's general elections next year are on track. That's according to the Electoral Commissioner, Pathetis Gatmo. Mr. Gatmo has been under increasing pressure from opposition MPs over some late changes to the electoral system, but denies he has been influenced by the government. PNG is due for its 5-year elections in late June, but numerous intending candidates have claimed that the common role of rife with errors. However, Mr. Gatmo told Johnny Blades that efforts to cleanse and update PNG's unwieldy role are progressing well.
Our role is inflated. That is a problem that I incurred when I came in. We are updating that role for 2017 election. Now, we have assistance from Australian Electoral Commission with claims about 109,000 ghost names. But there are still some ghost names there. So we are still working on that. We are updating the roll across the country. And as I'm speaking, I'm hoping to print the final roll by end of March.
One of the things the opposition MPs have been talking about is the move to bring the campaign period from 2 months to one, which the government seems to be determined to do. Is that all within the rules? And, I mean, is it up to you about the fee anyway?
It's within the rules, but basically it's for the parliament to debate and pass those two laws. What happens is, to start a process, I prepare cabinet submission. It goes to cabinet, and cabinet then sees the submission and knows it's to change laws. So what the opposition is saying is true. It has some merit, but really it's a law that's going to parliament for amendment. So they should debate that in parliament.
Do you think these changes have merit? Are these changes stemming from your recommendation?
Yes, there are some merits, but I rather leave it to parliament to debate the issue. I've mentioned some of the issues in relation to why fees should be increased, but I don't want to debate it publicly. But I've briefed the government and government caucus, so it's up to them to debate it in parliament.
Is it the case that the Electoral Commission has been underfunded during these last few years to prepare for this poll?
Yeah, for 2010, we started off with a budget of 10 billion kina to start the roll-up lady. Obviously, that was insufficient. But in the course of the year, the government provided us additional funding. So at the end of last year, they gave us some funding so we were able to go out and currently doing our roll-up dating across the country.
Is it enough?
Not really for the roll-up dating. But for the 2017 election, the government has allocated a budget of 400 million kina. 121 million kina will go to the security, and 279 million kina will be for the operation of the election.
It should be in June, shouldn't it, the actual polling weeks. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
It's not going to be changed, is it? People wouldn't want it to be delayed.
No. We have to conduct the election within a five-year anniversary. And so the timing is okay, still okay. The reduction of the campaign period will not affect the dates that were initially set for the exit polling and the counting. So that still remains.
Residents of an isolated island in Cook Islands are alarmed by the loss of their only doctor. But health officials say it's not an uncommon situation for remote Pacific Islands, and there are no systems in place to support nurses who provide health care there. The island of Managaya is 40 to 45 minutes by air to Rakatonga, and now it's far away from a doctor. The island's Red Cross officer, Liana Tokodi, says their resident doctor departed a couple of weeks ago, leaving nurses to provide health care on the island. She says there's a need for a doctor to care for the elderly and disabled. Joe O'Brien reports.
The island of Mangaia is a 40 to 45 minute flight away from Rarotonga, and now it's that far away from a doctor. The island's Red Cross officer, Leanne Taukia, says their resident doctor departed a couple of weeks ago, leaving nurses to provide healthcare on the island. She says there's a need for a doctor to care for the elderly and disabled on Mangaia.
It's not a good thing to have not a doctor. We really need a doctor here that can take over the doctor's work, because I believe that the nurses can't do the doctor's work sometimes.
Mangaia's mayor, Tere Atariki, agrees there is a need for a doctor to care for the island's 460-strong population of mainly old and young people. He says everyone is concerned by the departure of their doctor, and they've written to the Health Ministry about it. But Health Secretary Elizabeth Edor says she's told those who've raised concerns they've been very well taken care of by their nurses, and there are systems in place to support them.
These nurse practitioners and these nurses in these remote areas are actually not in isolation. They have the skill set and the knowledge that enables them to take care of the population out there. They have access to the doctors on Rarotonga for any support they require. And there's a continuous professional development program that's in place for them.
The Health Secretary says most of the outer islands do not have a doctor, but that does not put patients at greater risk in an emergency.
Emergency flights can happen whether you have a doctor on the ground or not. What has happened for the Cook Islands is they're actually having early identification of high-risk cases and trying to manage that in advance. The emergency situations through trauma, appendicitis, can happen, and that will need to be referred to Rarotonga. And that's how we've been managing the healthcare services in all the islands in the Cook Islands.
Elizabeth Edo says specialists also visit the outer islands for screening and case reviews, and she's confident they have the right people working there. World Health Organization Technical Officer Erica Reeve says nurses have been providing care on sparsely populated remote Pacific Islands for many years and have an important role to play.
The loss of a doctor to one of the islands doesn't necessarily mean that mortality and morbidity will go up in that particular area. The most important thing is that adequate primary and secondary health care are available. Things like immunizations for children, antibiotics, good antenatal care, management of NCD risk factors. Nurses, they're perfectly capable of managing those.
But the WHO officer concedes there is a greater risk in an emergency for people on very remote islands who don't have good transport links to tertiary services.
Yeah, definitely there would be for some emergencies. The nurses can't be trained up to cover all emergencies perfectly well. And it's not necessarily the capacity, it's also the technology that they have available to them, the tools and the access to particular medicines, and you can't expect them to cover to the degree a doctor would be able to.
Cook Islands Health Secretary Elizabeth Edo says it's not simply a case that having a doctor on each island would take care of business. She says it's about identifying what type of health professionals can best serve the country within budget considerations. This is Joe O'Brien.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A Russian monarch says he wants to use three uninhabited islands in Kiribati to create an alternative Russia. Anton Bakov wants to revive the Romanov Empire, which ended in 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution. Mr. Bakov is currently visiting Kiribati at the invitation of the government, which has yet to agree to the proposal. Amelia Langford reports.
Anton Bakov is a Russian businessman and the founder of Russia's Monarchist Party. Mr. Bakov wants to use three uninhabited islands in the southern line islands of Kiribati, making one of the islands, Maldon, his capital. Mr. Bakov's wife, Marina Bakova, who translated for her husband during our interview, spoke on his behalf.
This is the desire of not only the heir of the Russian throne of Nicholas III, but also a great number of Russian patriots who are not happy with Putin's regime and who would like to have the revival of Romanov Empire visible. Well, as an alternative Russia, maybe, as an alternative Russia.
Mr. Bakov says he chose Kiribati because the area has Russian connections due to Russian exploration in the 1800s. He says it would also be suitable for the chain of resorts he plans to build.
We are collaborating with several poor countries, and one of which is Kiribati. And Kiribati has a wonderful climate, and it's a very peaceful country, and we are interested in it because it's very neutral and very peaceful.
When asked what benefit the project will have for the people of Kiribati, he says he would be investing $350 million, and the resort complex would create jobs. But a former president of Kiribati, Teburoro Sito, says the project must be carefully considered, but it is an attractive proposal for Kiribati.
On one hand, we can see the benefits, the economic benefits that will be created in terms of turning Maldon into an ecotourism island, something like the Maldives.
Mr. Sito says that could be a big boost to the Kiribati tourism industry.
Assuming the things they're saying true and are correct, then I would like to see it happen. If they can do it without any cost on us, except the land which can host them, then I don't see any fuss at this stage.
However, a former Tongan politician and academic specialising in Pacific issues, Setaveni Halapua, is more sceptical. Dr. Halapua questions what Mr. Buckov's motives are and whether he's looking for a tax haven. He thinks reviving the Russian Empire in the Pacific is a very weird idea.
It's scary, you know, when you have people like that with money travelling around and try to set themselves up in some place with their own rules and regulations and stuff like that, and they can sell that to anybody else, the highest bidder. It's very strange indeed, but scary.
Dr. Halapua is urging the Kiribati government not to rush its decision and to do its homework on Mr. Buckov.
I can understand, you know, that the government of Kiribati is, you know, trying to do its best to raise as much resources they can to deal with their own problems, including climate change. But one has to remember that sometimes you think that this is the solution to your problem. It turns out to be make the problems worse.
Another academic, Paula Molisa of Victoria University, warns the Pacific is becoming the new hunting ground for predatory countries wanting to invest. He says it's a fine balancing act for governments around the region, trying to attract investors and ensure local sovereignty and good development. He says consultation with local communities is key.
If you look closely at a lot of these experiments too, they've often been ways of practicing a kind of cultural imperialism that actually runs roughshod over the voices and concerns of communities, you know, especially at the lower grassroots level.
A spokesperson for the Kiribati government says its Foreign Investment Commission is still considering the proposal and it's not yet a done deal. It's not the first time that Mr. Buckov has attempted to revive the Romanov Empire. The Cook Islands News reported in 2011 that Mr. Buckov announced he had bought Suwarrow Island and made it the new capital of his empire. The Cook Islands government promptly dismissed his claims as inaccurate and a con. This is Amelia Langford.
The Pacific's main scientific agency, the Pacific Community, marked its 70th anniversary. The community was set up when Australia and New Zealand invited the then colonial powers, the United States, Britain, the Netherlands, and France, to be part of an agency that aimed to secure the interests of the Western nations in the region following World War II. With the departure of the Dutch after the Indonesia annexation of Papua in 1962 and Britain's pullout of the region in the 1990s, the agency now has 26 members, including all island countries and territories in the Pacific. The community has become the Pacific's key body dealing with scientific and technical issues. It is currently headed by Colin Tukawanga, and Donald Wiseman asked him how it felt to get to 70.
Well, significant milestone, obviously. Don, we're excited about it. Longevity these days is something to celebrate, and we're planning a few things to mark the occasion, SBC being around 70 years, assisting the members with development activities.
When the organisation looks back over those 70 years, what have been the key things, do you think, for it and for the region?
Tuna stock assessment, the tuna fisheries database management, is a significant world-class activity, and that's helped inform members about decisions they might make on licensing and management of the tuna resource. The South Pacific Games was an SPC initiative all those years ago. It is self-governing these days, and one could say that that's a good example of successful development. The Arts Festival was a Pacific SPC initiative. Again, it's managed by the members. But if you just looked at public health, SBC scientists first started describing emerging diabetes, obesity and heart disease problem in island communities in the 70s, and we continue to do that work now. SBC has been providing information on surveillance for dengue and so on over the years. We've done a lot of work with young people on gender and empowerment of women, on educational standards, on human rights legislation and support, a whole manner of things.
Yes, it's almost a never-ending list, isn't it?
Sometimes I say to people it's probably easier to say what we're not involved in rather than to try to list everything, because inevitably you lose a few significant developments. But I hope from that few examples people get the feeling of what SPC has done over the years.
A critical area right now is the work to combat climate change. But you have a difficulty there because one of your members, a key member, a founding member, the United States, appears to be led by an administration that doesn't accept that climate change exists. So how do you combat that?
Well, first thing to say is that the United States, the government of the United States, is a valuable member, and we've worked very constructively over the years. And this change, of course, is a concern, it's fair to say, but the momentum is there, we think, and we'd like to believe that the global community will continue to support the agreements that have been signed. And certainly from our point of view, we look forward to continuing the work and recognizing the change in priorities. But we're confident that there is sufficient momentum, there is sufficient concern, and that we continue to push ahead and honor those commitments that have been made by the global community.
Do you have any concerns about funding from the US?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the contribution is significant, and if we don't get that funding resource through either directly to us, as we have done, or through the bilateral agreement, or indeed the Green Climate Fund, it is, of course, a concern, and that's clearly going to be a subject for continued conversation.
Now, the Pacific Islands Forum at its summit last year brought in a couple of new members, and it's talking about others, and it's now broadening this organization, the Pacific Islands Forum, and it's looking increasingly like the Pacific community. Do you see it that way?
No, I don't, because the forum deals primarily with support for the leaders' political issues. And for the most part, we're the technical scientific agency. And for the most part, despite what people might say, we work very well with the forum. They lead the work on the framework for regionalism, for example. But when it comes to design and implementation of the practical responses to the, say, the priorities adopted by the leaders, that's our work. So, for example, on cervical cancer, that's the health and public health issues are led by SBC. So I think in the climate change area, there's potential for some murkiness and confusion. But again, we are meeting with SPREP and other colleagues early next month in Honiara to continue to try and make clear who does what.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. Also, I want to tell you that if you want to listen to this program again or past editions, you can visit our website at any time, www.pcjmedia.com, and just click on the link for Focus Asia Pacific. So on behalf of the whole team here at PCJ Radio International and the Focus Asia Pacific team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. So long. Bye-bye.